On WGN, the Wintrust Business Lunch is produced by Pete Zimmerman. This is John Williams. Thanks for joining us. We're here Monday through Friday from noon to 1. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We start today with Paul Nolte, Senior Vice President at Kingsview Wealth Management. Kingsview.com is the website. Paul, welcome back. How are you today?
Not too bad. Enjoying the warm summer sunshine.
Yeah, I am too. This is my kind of weather. And I don't know if it's everybody's kind of market, but is the place we are in right now this, that the economy is not great, but the worst of it is past, and things are slowly getting better. Is that a fair description?
I think it is. And really, when you look at the markets, and it's why everybody's kind of scratching their head trying to figure out, okay, why are the markets at near all-time highs?
You notice I said economy, not markets, because of that.
Exactly.
Finish that thought.
And the markets are looking at the economy, but they don't look at the absolutes. They look at it, relatively speaking. Is it getting better or is it getting worse? And the answer is, yes, it's getting better. The second part of it is the Fed has basically indicated they're going to be sitting on the sidelines now for quite some time. So monetary policy is going to be very easy, and Wall Street loves easy monetary policy.
The thing that worries me the most, and this has been a theme the last 2 weeks, is that if the markets are saying something about the economy, good, but really it's five companies are benefiting from this economy, and they're doing good. But for that, I wonder if we even have the markets that we have right now.
If you take a look at the S&P 500 and you say, all right, let's equally weight all of the 500 companies, and there are mutual funds and ETFs that do that, those are probably down about 8% for the year.
That's all.
Whereas the S&P is up about 8%. So there's a 16 percentage point swing between the S&P 500 and the equal weight S&P. So, yeah, you're right. But, again, a lot of those companies, Walmart, Target, they have benefited. You take a look at UPS, they have benefited. You look at truckers, they've benefited. So there have been a lot of different companies that continue to do well. And a lot of the service part of the economy has done very poorly. So think hotels, think cruise lines, transportation, airlines, restaurants. Those haven't done as well. So, again, in general, it's better, but it's certainly not robust.
I wonder if I make widgets. There will always be a need for widgets, and they'll come back. But I wonder if the service sector is ever going to come back, or say in the next 10 years going to come back to the level it's been at?
That's a answer. And the reason I say that is because there's a lot around that. So come on downtown Chicago, take a look at all the office buildings that right now nobody's going to. And many of them may never go back to, certainly not in the capacity that they were before. So what do we do with all of that real estate? A lot of people working at home, certainly not in the service sector, although a fair amount are, you know, in the financial services, to be sure. Many of those may not come back, and I'm not sure we're going to have a manufacturing economy as strong as it used to be 50, 60 years ago. We are predominantly a service economy now. About 2/3 to 70% of the economy is services. And that's part of the reason why you're seeing the numbers as poor from an economic perspective as you do.
So I headlined this segment with what does the S&P 500 stunning summer mean? I mean, it's did you see this coming?
Not to this extent. We knew that in March things were bad. We knew that valuations got to levels that were, okay. Now we are back to valuation levels that really portend the next 5 years returns not that great anymore, similar to what we saw at the beginning of the year. So from a short-term basis, yes, the momentum is strong and it can continue on for a while. But when you look at the fundamentals of many of these companies and what they could earn, over the next 3 to 5 years, they've already accounted for much of those gains. So we think over the next 3 to 5 years, the markets are going to kind of struggle. But in the short term, this momentum can last a while.
Over the next 3 to 5 years, you're not optimistic about the S&P. I didn't know you all forecast that far out.
You can with you're making the assumption that we make is that earnings are generally going to go with the economy. And the economy generally grows at 2, maybe 3% a year, and we grow those earnings that far out. And then we assign a range of valuations, a PE of 20 or 15 or 10, and then we can extrapolate what that rate of return will be, an assumed rate of return. And those numbers right now are very low single digits out the next 5 years or so. And historically, that's had a pretty good correlation to actual returns, something north of about 70% or so.
Well, do you have a thought about what the fundamental value is of a bunch of American companies? That are they over? Well, some of these perhaps are overvalued right now. Are some of them undervalued? I'm thinking about everything from computers to cars, clothes,
sure.
Things that I know.
Yeah. Well, taken in different pieces, yes, the technology sector is very expensive. And when you look at the growth part of the economy, technology plays a large role in that. If you look at what we would consider value stocks, those that are maybe down and out a little bit, selling for cheaper valuations, and think there in the banking sector, a lot of the financial companies are very cheap, but they've been cheap for a while, and they may continue to be that way. So valuations are a lousy timing tool, but they're very good, I think, at projecting longer-term rates of returns.
One last sector, just real quick. What do you think about the energy sector? That's not been doing that well. Is that just because the economy has stalled? Do you expect that to bounce back?
Not to the extent I think that many do, and that is also indicative of the overall economy. We are using a little bit more energy, we are traveling a little bit more, but we are also producing an awful lot, not only here in the United States, but certainly around the world. So there still is a fair amount of energy around. So at $40, $45 a barrel, we may get up to 50 or 55, but we've been kind of stuck in that range now for the last 3 or 4 years, and I think that's probably close to fair value, but we don't see that going up to $100 or $150 a barrel where you're really going to see energy take off like it has in years past.
Paul Nolte, Senior Vice President at Kingsview Wealth Management. Visit kingsview.com. Nice to talk to you, Paul. Thanks for your time today. Have a good weekend. 1227. Hey, Matthew, you're on WGN Radio. How are you, sir?
Hi, John. Thank you for having me. Happy Friday.
I want to say your last name all by myself, and then you tell me if I get it right, okay? You can actually tutor me on this. It's Pietrafetta.
That's beautifully pronounced. And I say to my students, if you pronounce my name correctly, that immediately earns you an extra point on the ACT.
What is the origin? What nationality is Pietrafetta?
I like to say it's a short Irish name, but a nice long multi-vowel Italian name.
Italian name. You're the founder and CEO of Academic Approach. Okay, we found you a little early here. Give me a couple of minutes here. We'll pause for some news and markets, and then we'll continue this conversation on the other side. But this is a tutoring company, is that right?
Absolutely. We provide test preparation and academic tutoring in Chicagoland.
Is that a franchise, or is that your own private business?
No, I founded it in 2001, and since 2001, we've worked with thousands of Chicagoland students one-on-one and through our school programs. To provide test preparation around high school and college admissions.
Ah, so test preparation, getting ready for the ACT. You're not going to tutor me on algebra just because I have trouble with algebra all year long.
If you'd like me to, I'm always ready.
No, but I mean serious. Is your model just for those major tests, or is it a sort of anybody that's struggling with French, English, Spanish, history, there are those services as well?
What differentiates our test preparation is that it's an academically enriching form of test preparation, hence Academic Approach. So we don't just do tips and tricks and game the test. So we've always done academic tutoring along the way as well. And that service has become incredibly relevant during COVID and when we have remote learning and students needing supplementary instruction around remote learning. So it's become a big focus, as you can imagine, under current circumstances of our instruction. So, yes, we do offer academic tutoring as well as test preparation.
Still, I got to ask, are there some tricks to those tests? Is C a good answer? Should I go faster or slower on a standardized test? What do you tell people when they ask questions like that?
Well, we're sort of school of hard knocks, and we say, I'm sorry, you've got to learn what a semicolon is and what a colon is, and we're going to do a little bit of learning the old-fashioned way because these are tests of skills and college readiness, and we really can't game them. Sorry to be disappointing.
Is it true, though, that, I mean, so then the challenge for the test maker is to find something that truly assesses my academic ability, right?
Absolutely. And if you look at the test, and they're sort of lightning rod issues these days for a lot of good reasons. There's quite a bit of debate, and these are really divisive at this point to be supportive of the test as a meaningful academic tool. But we've felt for the past, 19 years that they are academically enriching. To undertake the instruction can actually bolster your GPA in school and make you college ready. Yeah. They do assess skills that are highly relevant to your performance in your high school and your college classrooms. So there's a lot of overlap between the curriculum material on the tests and in the classrooms. And, for example, the writing section of these tests, they each have a grammar section. Most teachers agree they don't want their students writing with run-on sentences or comma splices or fragments, but that's precisely what the test assesses. So we find a lot of happy overlaps, convenient overlaps between the work teachers that we work with in school are doing and what the tests are attempting to assess. And we call it teaching beyond the test as opposed to teaching to the test. So Instead of tips and tricks, try to focus on the skills that last.
Matthew Piatafeta is the founder and CEO of Academic Approach. Okay, let's continue this conversation then. I'll bet business is good. So let's continue our conversation with Matthew Piatafeta. He is the founder and CEO of a company called Academic Approach. AcademicApproach.com is the website for an independent business in the Chicago area. Are you in the city per se? Is that where you're located, Matthew?
We have offices in Lincoln Park on the North Shore and the western suburbs, so we're throughout Chicagoland.
Test preparation. I just read and interviewed one of the co-authors of the book Unacceptable, which talked about how people try to get into certain colleges and they do so by cheating. It's the college admissions scandal. What was your sort of observation about that whole thing?
It's unfortunate. There are a number of inequities in the system, and they're vast. And what ends up happening is that the test itself, the SAT or the ACT or the high school entrance exam, the selective enrollment exam, they can become heavily politicized, and understandably so. There are abuses, there are inequities, largely within the K-12 education system. But the way that we like to approach the test is sort of as a means to an academic end. So if they are indeed assessing college readiness and high school readiness skills, then let's build meaningful instruction around them. And we do that through our one-on-one test preparation with our students, and we do it in conjunction with schools. A lot of our CPS partners and other schools that we work with in other districts, we partner with the faculty and say, how do we, integrate in some of this instruction so we can raise scores and skills, and not see it as a divisive issue, but see it as part of the student's larger academic enterprise. So we take a positive view, but I do concede and understand all the negativity and the divisiveness around it. And right now it's a question of equity and access. Some students have the ability to access these tests with all the cancellations around COVID-related issues. And it's a struggle right now for schools and parents to think about balance safety for their children with the opportunity to take a test. So it's made the landscape even more complicated and divisive.
Well, I hadn't thought about that. If I'm going to take a standardized test, I usually go to some central location with a bunch of people, and that way they can monitor the honesty and integrity of the test. How are they doing that now?
Well, since March, when we went shelter in place, there have been vast cancellations. And hundreds of thousands of students that haven't been able to sit for tests that they were scheduled for, and much, much frustration from families who are trying to find opportunities to reschedule those dates. And the first available tests just happened from ACT in July, but there were last-minute cancellations from test centers, families driving out of state in order to get access to test centers. And, of course, those are families that have the means to do so. So those who do not have access are further kind of marginalized from the opportunity.
Right, because they're either not going to get a test, or if they're unhappy with their last test score, they're not going to get another chance to retake it. Would you prioritize the tests? That is the ACT the most important one? Is the SAT the most of the PSAT? Which tests are we talking about here, and how important are they?
You know, it's interesting. When they first came to Chicago in 2001, that was the first year that Illinois adopted the ACT as a state-mandated exam, graduation requirement for all high school students in all public school districts. And then, recently in 2016, the State Board of Education switched to the SAT. So since then, the SAT has been the state-mandated exam. So it's a graduation requirement. And, you know, State Board of Education just said recently that it will remain a graduation requirement. So you must take an SAT if you're a public school student to graduate. And now one of the debates is around when. So for the class of 2021 that has been most limited by these test cancellations and school closures, district administrators are trying to determine, do we give it to them in the fall? Will we be able in September and October to administer safely an SAT, or will we give it in April? If you don't give it to students in the fall, then it will not be a relevant criterion for their college applications. If you wait till April, sure, it's a state-mandated requirement, but it's not helping them with college. So there's a lot of discussion and debate around how to get our class of 2021 seniors a state-mandated SAT right now.
What happens when somebody takes it and then they're not happy with the score? What do they do to improve the score, right? Like maybe my English was off or my math was off. I don't know. Sort of do a deep dive then in those subject areas? Or is it maybe the way the person is taking the test? They're actually just not maximizing their test score because they're not answering enough questions or whatever?
It's a great question. We try to take a really diagnostic approach to that. And this is how we work with a lot of our school partners. So we itemize all the test items and tie them to a curriculum category. So if you, for example, took a test and perhaps didn't do so well on the English portion, as you're saying, there's a story behind that. It may be that sentence construction, certain rules and fragments, run-ons, misplaced modifiers. That's your area you need to work on. The data will show that, and then we can tailor make instruction to just target those skills. Or maybe, in fact, the commas. You know, you like to overuse your commas. You're a little too generous with them, but you need to understand how to use them and when to use them and why to use them. So we target that lesson. So what we use is the data in a really detailed analysis to drive a customized plan. The answer can be different. You could have the same score as another student for totally different reasons from a curricular standpoint. And so your instructional solution needs to be differentiated. We say at Academic Approach, tests are standardized, students are not, so we try to individualize and personalize all instruction.
By the way, are you hired by groups? Like, do the school districts hire you, or do individuals hire you?
Well, we have two divisions. We have our one-on-one tutoring programs where families will come to us, and they will seek a one-on-one tailored program for an individual student. And then we also, last year we worked with 170 different schools and districts and delivered classroom instruction over 6,000 students in schools. So we also have school partners and school district partners. But this year, one thing that we're hearing a lot from both schools and from families is they're looking for academic supplemental support. We call it study teams. But they're looking for small group personalized instruction because one big concern is with remote learning going on for many students, in many districts are, will the instruction be personalized enough? Will there be enough engagement for students? Will they be lost on a Zoom, hiding on a black screen? Will they be held accountable? So a lot of questions that we're getting this year from both schools and our one-on-one families that work with us is, can you help make remote learning more effective and engaging?
I presume the answer is yes, right?
The answer is yes, but I will say this is a work in progress with a lot of school partners and families trying to figure out how best to collaborate with schools and to support individualized, tailored instruction. This is a whole new world. We have families sometimes calling us and saying, hey, can you homeschool us? We don't really love the idea of remote learning, and we want in-person in our home. And you've read the headlines. This is the micro school or the pod. It's a trend across the country, and a lot of folks are looking for guidance. So we've been doing this work for a long time and are basing our solutions on the best research on how to have meaningful, effective small groups that allow us to really engage in personalized instruction for students. But it's a concern for many families. I know I have a 16-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 2-year-old, and I watched e-learning for the past couple months of last school year, and I did see teachers working really hard to try to get engagement, but also the ways in which a student can kind of hide out on a Zoom or a Google Meets and not necessarily get what they would get when they were in person.
Well, people space out on Zoom meetings. I guess students are quite capable of doing that on Zoom classes, too. And, you know, I'm hearing from parents on this on my 9 to noon show that the schools, the teachers are doing a much better job this time than when they had to scramble last time. So that's encouraging.
It's positive. Yeah. It's very, very positive. And we won't know. We don't know what we don't know, though. It is, if you look at the research, where the average high school student over the summer will lose 30% of their math, for example, just summer learning loss. When you add on a couple of extra months to that, is it, you know, 50% now? What is it? And so I think one of the concerns we'll see in the research is how much have we lost and how much do we have to regain? And some of the research around this is a bit concerning for sure.
Nice to talk to you, Matthew. Continued success, Academic Approach. Visit academicapproach.com. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John, so much. Take
Interesting.
Care.
Yeah, timely, too. 12:42. Speaking of timely, more business news. This is Steve Bertrand.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. The federal government will buy almost all of the 15-minute COVID tests that Abbott Laboratories plans to make this year. Bloomberg says the government will pay $750 million for 150 million tests. United is warning of even bigger cuts if the government doesn't agree on some form of emergency funding. Says it could furlough up to 2,850 pilots. That's more than 25% of their total. And Cook County Health is warning of cost cutting. Could include layoffs and even some consolidations of clinics. Crane says it's facing a $187 million deficit. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
And Orion Samuelson's got some agribusiness news. Oh,
fairly quiet day in the grain trade at the Chicago Board of Trade. September wheat, for example, down 2¾ cents a bushel. September corn is trading up 0.75 cents a bushel. September soybeans, however, showing a little life. They're up 11 cents a bushel. And as we check livestock future numbers at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, October lean hog contract down $1.80 a hundredweight, August live cattle up 22 cents a hundredweight, and the September feeder cattle contract is up $1.17 a hundredweight. There was more export activity in the grain market today, and the number this time, corn, 324,000 tons. The recipient, unknown, but that's the only sale today after getting soybean and corn sales earlier this week. Again, county fair season, state fair season, not happening this year. Still getting emails from people saying, Sandwich Fair, will that be held? No, the Sandwich Fair will not be held. Again, all of the postponements and the cancellations because of the COVID-19 situation. So you'll have to find your own celebration or your own food festival. You can still go to farmers markets, but remember, you do have different rules to follow if you go to a farmers market, and I hope you do, because we've got a good crop of locally produced produce that is certainly available at those farmers markets. That's your money on 720 WGN.
12:48 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Dale Buss joins us once again. Dale, I trust you've been well. How are you today?
I have. Thank you, John. Appreciate the invitation.
Veteran journalist, covers a bunch of things, most notably the auto industry. You've read him in Forbes, chief executive in Automotive News. Out of the gate, how are car sales right now?
Well, they're actually snapping back pretty well, considering everything. I mean, you certainly hear a lot about the auto industry in terms of, you know, fighting to maintain production through COVID-19, wearing masks to dealerships, all that kind of thing. But the reality is that the industry has been pretty optimistic from the start of the reopening of economies, and their confidence turns out to have been pretty well placed as people have, you know, kind of fought to get back to whatever normal is. They need and want vehicles, and there's an extra boost now because a lot of people are really feeling that maybe they'll consider buying a car when they wouldn't have before because of their fears about germs and COVID-19 and so on going forward. So the industry is coming back, you know, pretty soundly. A lot of companies and plants are back at production levels they were before. So it's a fairly optimistic picture. Obviously, it depends on the economic backdrop and politics and all that. But the industry is a fairly much a bright spot.
Well, I guess you need two things, right? Production and then demand. So production is okay. They're able to make sufficient quantities of vehicles, and there is a demand. The low interest rates have to be helpful, right?
Yeah, low interest rates are absolutely crucial to all of this. But another thing is that there's, you know, a surprising number of really attractive and interesting new vehicles coming out that are making showrooms and online looking really interesting for consumers. I mean, you've got a whole range of all new SUVs in the midsize range that are coming out this year. Over the last couple of years, you've had a lot of all new big SUVs like the big Volkswagen Atlas and the big Kia Telluride. So the foreign makers have been kind of matching what the Detroit 3 have always offered in terms of big SUVs for millennials, I guess, and their growing families. And then you've got the pickup truck wars that are continuing unabated. That's about where the industry gets maybe half its profits, especially the American companies. So, you know, Ford just came out with a new version of F-150, the nation's best-selling vehicle, and GM and Ram are all in there competing as well. So that's just, especially as the economy picks up steam and contractors and construction companies and everybody want to get in on the action, you know, pickup trucks just continue to be really, really hot.
You have any
advice? Interestingly,
oh, go ahead. Finish.
What's that? Well, I was going to say one segment that most American consumers are still kind of used to overlooking are electric vehicles. And I just drove the brand new Mini E, and it was like the ride of a lifetime. It's like imagine a something two or three times the size of a golf cart. But like, it, you know, neck snapping torque and speed, you can go from 0 to 60 in like 4 or 5 seconds. So there are just some really interesting vehicles out there for people.
That's kind of hilarious sounding to me. You're in this little golf cart that goes lightning quick, huh?
Oh, it's absolutely fun to drive. But, you know, there are a whole number of all new electrics and hybrids that are coming out as the industry continues to kind of embrace this new paradigm for propulsion, even though consumers are still a little bit behind them.
Well, the big challenge for that sector was the battery. Has that been solved?
Well, not solved. I mean, this Mini E that I mentioned still only has a range of about 90 miles on a charge. So, you know, basically it's a really fun commuter vehicle. Then in the typical garage, you've got to charge it all night to get it back to snuff. But starting with the Chevrolet Bolt a couple of years ago and certainly Tesla's Model 3, I mean, those are ranges of up to 200 miles and more. So you can, you know, essentially drive that car for a week with normal usage without having to recharge them. So they're getting more and more practical and more challenging, you know, to the traditional gas-powered vehicles, even though obviously gasoline prices are pretty low.
Yeah, right. So how do those things price out then? Tesla was expensive and then came down, depending on the model. Are we comparable to gas powered
cars?
Well,
you can in the 30,000s, you can get the Chevy Bolt, you can get the Tesla Model 3, and those are simply in no way yet comparable to the prices that you can pay for similarly equipped, let's say, gasoline powered vehicles. I mean, there's still quite a price gap, but it'll continue to come down as the technology improves and as volume goes up and allows the automakers to scale. But, you know, that's an interesting point, too, is that the typical sedan, which has been falling out of favor with American consumers and car makers over the last several years, is making a little bit of a comeback. And part of it is this factor that I mentioned where more people are kind of being drawn from the margins into the car market. And if they've never owned a car before, you know, maybe they're going to want to start out with the most reasonable priced vehicles that they can get. And so something like the all-new Nissan Sentra, which has been around for a long time, but in a new version, makes a great and very capable, you know, econo box, if you will, for somebody coming into the market.
You mentioned also the Fiat Chrysler's brands are doing pretty well.
Yeah. They're doing very well. I mean, the company came back from the dead basically on the strength of the Jeep and Ram brands. Now, Dodge has been kind of redefined as a performance brand. They're not trying to cover the market with Dodges anymore. But what's interesting, the most recent development for Fiat Chrysler is they've always been at the bottom of the product quality pyramid, if you will, the totem pole. And this year, for the first time, they became the first domestic brand, Dodge did, to top the J.D. Power quality rankings, which are based on surveys of millions or at least thousands of American consumers. So Fiat Chrysler's brands have gone from, you know, zero to hero in terms of product quality, which is really remarkable and should provide a really nice boost for a company that's been doing well and now it has, you know, it can say we make the best vehicles quality-wise. It's quite a help.
Dale, when I hear J.D. Power is quoted in ads for vehicles, I sometimes wonder how seriously do I take that? Is that legitimate information or just fluff? If it says J.D. Power,
well,
should I trust that?
Well, actually you do, yeah, because as I said, these surveys that J.D. Power has been conducting for decades are based on thousands of surveys of actual customers. And so they're not so much awards as they are, I mean, yeah, there's a trophy attached, and you always see photos of them, but it's recognition based on these surveys of actually how consumers perceive the initial quality of their vehicles. So they're very legit. Now, whether J.D. Power should be allowing these brands to use their trophies in their ads is another issue, but the actual ratings themselves are very much a reflection of what's happening in the vehicles and also how consumers are perceiving them.
That's an interesting point. Consumer Report has something to say about that, don't they?
Well, yes. And the difference with Consumer Reports is, again, something to be taken very seriously if you're buying a car. Their evaluations are based on their own reviews, driving of vehicles, you know, very rigorous testing and opinion making. So they're to be taken very seriously, but kind of for an entirely different reason.
Yeah. Nice to talk to you. I know that you wrote about the Bronco, but I'm out of time today, Dale. We'll catch up again soon. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Appreciate you. Bet, John.
Dale Buss is a veteran journalist, writes for Chief Executive Automotive News, Forbes, and joins us frequently on the Wintrust Business Lunch.